This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website at progressive.org. Today, it's an honor to have in the studio with me Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, a leading human rights activist and practitioner of nonviolence in Palestine. He's the founder of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society and a co-founder and secretary general of Al Mubadara, the Palestinian National Initiative that calls for internal democracy and good governance. Dr. Barghouti was recently elected as a member of the Palestinian Parliament as an independent, a member neither of Fatah or Hamas. Dr. Barghouti, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Can you give me a little background about yourself? Where were you born and what were the conditions as you grew up?
I was born in Jerusalem in 54, and then my father worked in Ramallah city, so we lived most of our life in that city. He originates from a village near Ramallah called Deir Hassani. So I grew up there, and then I went to the Soviet Union where I studied medicine.
What was that like?
It was fun. I mean, it was a nice time, and people were very hospitable, and we had good education. It was a very good university. Then I came back and specialized in cardiology, intensive, and internal medicine, and worked for a long time in one of the biggest hospitals in Jerusalem called Maqasid Hospital.
As a heart surgeon? Or an intern?
No, as an internist. Mm-hmm. And right from the beginning, we decided to establish a movement because we recognized a health movement because we recognized that there was a very serious deterioration of the health situation under military occupation. And we initiated Palestinian medical relief committees, which became a grassroots, non-governmental, voluntary health movement that gradually grew up to become the largest, probably, non-governmental organization in Palestine in terms of its influence and effect, serving now about 495 communities, about 1.3 million people every year.
Oh, that's amazing.
But then I came to the States here, and later I got training in management. I was a Sloan Fellow at Stanford University in California, and I got a master's in the science of management there. But probably if I want to say about, I mean, I think the most crucial thing that affected my life was when I was 12 years old was the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories in 67. I think since then I had this very powerful sense of duty and responsibility, like many other people in my generation, and that we must find a way of getting rid of this occupation, find a way of becoming free again, find a way of regaining the dignity of the Palestinian people. And I think this has shaped up a lot of the activities that came later in the political life.
Are there images or memories you have of those first few months or years of occupation?
Absolutely. I think it was a shock for everybody. I mean, a shock for all of us. We had relied and thought that the Arab countries like Egypt would be able to defend us from the Israeli attack and would be able to defeat Israel. And we suddenly saw them all collapse one after the other. And the very presence of the Israeli army transformed the whole life in the occupied territories. Suddenly you cannot travel from one place to another without a permit. Every little bureaucratic procedure requires lengthy and awful processes. I mean, it's very hard to really describe it because every aspect of life is affected. I'll give you one example. We needed a phone line, and we applied for a phone line, and our family, it took us 12 years to get it.
No phone for 12 years?
No phone for 12 years. So the first thing that shocked me when I came to Stanford was that I could order two phone lines in 15 minutes, you know. I called home immediately and said, guess what? I could get two phones, you know, two phone lines in 15 minutes. I mean, traveling was a disaster. I mean, you could just, I mean, I know here in the United States, you had a very big very big activity and campaign about allowing the Russians to travel out of the Soviet Union at one point of time, including Jewish people, of course. But we as Palestinians, up till this moment, do not have that freedom of being able to just fly out or travel from one place to another. Not even, not just leaving the country to another country, but even traveling now from one region to the other. And during the last 40 years, this occupation is going to be almost 40 years next year. This is the longest occupation, military occupation in modern history. And it's the worst. And I'll give you just one example. Even people, we are a small country, very small. I mean, the distances are not very big. But traveling from one region to the other is almost like an impossible mission.
From West Bank to Gaza or even in between?
From West Bank to Gaza, it's already impossible since many years. Unless you have very special kind of permit. Going to Jerusalem, I was born in Jerusalem. I worked in Jerusalem for many years of my life. And when the peace process started in 1991, Israel blocked Jerusalem completely. So regardless of whether it was peace, process, conflict going on, the measures, the Israeli measures were increasing every year, every month. As I said, I am born in Jerusalem and I cannot go there. Even during the election campaign, although the people in East Jerusalem are allowed to vote, I wanted to campaign with them. You know, I ran for president and I came second in the presidential elections. During the presidential campaign, which was 6 weeks, I was stopped, arrested, or beaten by the Israeli army 8 times, including 3 times, 3 arrests in Jerusalem, just because I was just walking in the street trying to talk to the voters about the elections. So the restrictions are horrible. One of the problems we have now is 570 or almost 620, actually, Israeli military checkpoints that prevent people from moving from one area to another. Just to give you an example of what that means, I have an executive assistant who works with me from a city called Jenin. Usually the trip between Jenin and Ramallah, where our office is, takes about 1 hour and 20 minutes. Now it takes her 9 hours, if she can, get through. And she has to cross at least 7 checkpoints. So that means to be at work at 9 in the morning, she has to leave home at 1 or at 12 midnight. Which means she cannot go home, basically, for a month or two. I mean, every month or two, she goes once. And the same applies to many things. Up till now, 110 Palestinian women had to give birth at checkpoints because they were not allowed to cross to the hospitals. 1/3 of them lost their babies. So that's how, I mean, daily life is a misery. You know, I do not wish for any people in the world to be living under military occupation.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm talking with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, a member of the Palestinian Parliament, a founder of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society, and many other organizations. You've been an advocate of nonviolence despite all these hardships of the occupation that you've been describing. Tell me about that, how you arrived at that.
Well, first of all, let me tell you that we are part of a new political movement in Palestine that is not very well known in the States and many other places, although it was co-founded by late Dr. Edward Said, who is a close friend, really, and a fantastic person. This movement tries to represent a third alternative to Hamas and fundamentalist group and to the Fatah governing part that used to be a governing party with lots of corruption and problems. We try to give people a different alternative, an alternative that is loyal to the Palestinian rights of freedom, dignity, independence, and to the cause of two-state solution, but at the same time that advocates nonviolent approach to struggle as the best approach that can serve the interest of the Palestinian people. And also we call a lot for democratic transformation and social justice. I think these are the 4 major characteristics. And nonviolence, in our case, has been very effective. We've been organizing a lot of demonstrations, a lot of marches.
You know, we don't hear about that in the United States.
You don't, because in the United States, the media tends to give you, I'm sorry to say that, a misrepresentation of reality. And frequently, everything that is told about the West Bank and Gaza and Palestine is controlled by the Israeli narrative, or have to be compatible with the Israeli narrative.
Can you give examples of
and
some
paradigm
of
the situation? Yeah,
of some of the nonviolent actions.
Of course, our struggle against the wall. You know, the wall that the Israelis call a fence is a structure that is 8 to 10 meters high of concrete. Wall that is really destroying various aspects of life, health, education.
And it's cutting right through
economy.
Palestinian land.
It is not a wall that is built between Palestinians and Israelis, as you might think. It's a wall that goes inside Palestinian cities and neighborhoods. It is deep inside the West Bank, as deep as 22 kilometers inside the occupied territories. And its aim is to annex land, basically, annex settlements with land, and the illegal settlements. And the wall is separating Palestinians from Palestinians, not Israelis from Palestinians. And it has no security purpose whatsoever, because I managed myself to cross it several times and get to Jerusalem without them being able to stop me. So if they can't stop me, I'm sure they cannot stop others. In my opinion, it's the security issue here is only a pretext for using this wall to create new borders that will take away at least half of the West Bank, which is, by the way, West Bank and Gaza are only 22% of the land of historic Palestine. So if you take half of the West Bank away from people, you're practically killing the option of two-state solutions and killing the option of peace based on two-state solution. So what we do, we organize nonviolent demonstrations in which not only Palestinians participate, but also internationals, a lot of internationals from the United States, people like late Rachel Corey, who unfortunately had to sacrifice her life when she was defending Palestinians from the Israeli bulldozers, and she was bulldozed herself by the Israeli army.
And I know there's a group, Rabbis for Human Rights, that does some of this activity.
Yes, more than that. We have almost now in every demonstration of ours, we have Israeli peace activists participating with us. And this gives us a lot of hope and courage, of course. That these actions, I mean, we have now villages that organize every Friday or every Saturday a demonstration against the wall. It has become like a tradition, and it is consolidating peaceful, nonviolent approach. The important thing here for us as a political movement is that you cannot just preach Hamas and others that nonviolence is better than violence. We had to practice it. We had to show it. We had to show how effective it is and how popular it can be. And I think this is going to influence all the political movement. I think I am almost sure now that all the other political groups, even Hamas, are ready to give up armed struggle and military actions completely if given one condition, that Israel itself will not continue to do military actions and assassinations and so on.
But that's the pattern. That's the Israeli practice. And so it's unlikely, at least I'm skeptical, that Israel would surrender that tactic, even though they are illegal tactics, these assassinations.
That's why we say to the other groups, even if they violate, let's not respond.
But just again, to carry on with my skepticism, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, a lot of people are interpreting the Hamas victory as a vindication of their violent strategy, that because Israel under Sharon was being so intransigent, and previous governments as well, that Hamas, by being violent, was standing up to the Israeli violence, and that's what people wanted. Is that a correct interpretation?
Some people interpret it this way. Maybe some people voted for Hamas on that basis, but this is not the main thing.
What's the main thing?
The main thing is that Hamas does not have more than 25 to 30% of support, which is related to its good organization being clean and providing social services to people mainly. But the rest of the votes they got, which is additional 13-14%, some of which were our votes that shifted to them, were votes of opposition and protest. People were so fed up with Fatah, fed up with corruption, fed up with mismanagement, fed up with the fact that Fatah has been talking about a peace process that never happened, fed up with the promises that were never fulfilled, fed up with the promises that Fatah will make good deals with the United States and the checkpoints will be removed and the economy will improve. They gave Abbas, Abu Mazen, they elected Abu Mazen democratically. I mean, that's the reason why I did not win the elections against him. I mean, we were close, but he got higher votes and he was elected. But for a whole year, Abbas was governing alone. His government was a Fatah government. He controlled the parliament with 80% of the of a majority of more than 80%. And still, Israel would not negotiate with him. The Israeli government used to say, Abbas is a favorable candidate. Arafat we will not talk to, but we will talk with Abbas. He became the president. And still they didn't talk to him.
And why was that, do you think?
Because they don't want to talk to anybody. The Israeli government wants to impose its unilateral solution. And that's why I think some of them are very happy now that Hamas got elected, because they can say there is no Palestinian partner. The truth is, if we bring Mother Teresa back from her grave and make her the prime minister of Palestine, still they wouldn't talk to her. They wouldn't talk to, you know, even if we bring an Israeli and make him a prime minister of Palestine, I am sure they wouldn't talk to him, because Sharon had this plan, unilateral plan, which is to annex more than half of the West Bank, to destroy the idea of Palestinian state and make it only clusters of prisons and pantostans. And that is what's happening on the ground. So I want to go back to the issue of Hamas. Hamas got the votes, 43%, only because these were protest votes and only because people thought that this is the best way of punishing Fatah. Nobody thought that Hamas will get the majority in the parliament. And they got the majority even with 43% only because of the bad election system. But believe me, that does not mean that Hamas has a majority in the Palestinian community. And what is overlooked here is that we had a true democratic revolution, a true democratic transformation.
Under, how so?
Yes, under difficult conditions of severe occupation, we managed to have a transformation. We struggled for democracy, not Hamas. We struggled to have elections, not Hamas. For 15, 20 years, we spent 20 years of our life demanding a transformation from one-party rule into multi-party system and free democratic elections. And finally, we managed to have them after the death of Arafat. So we had a fantastic presidential elections with violations. But because of these violations and our resistance to them, we ended up having the best parliamentary elections in the region. And now Palestine is a democracy. It's a real democracy. I mean, it has good potential for becoming a full democratic system, and it is the first time in the Arab world. So I don't know why the Israelis are upset. They should be happy. They claim that they are the only democracy in the Middle East. Now they have a democratic neighbor. And I believe, regardless of the results of the last elections, we still have a majority of 70% who want two-state solution, and I still believe that democracy will empower not only us as people, but it will be a precondition for finally having true negotiations that could lead to a solid peace in the area.
Well, I hope you're right about that, Dr. Barghouti. But Israel is not happy because Hamas is dedicated, at least in its principles, to not recognizing anyway or abolishing the state of Israel. It's dedicated in tactics, or has been, to engaging in bombings of civilians. And so that's why the Israelis are seizing on the election as saying, we've got no one to talk to.
No, Hamas, first of all, Hamas has declared very clearly since February last year that they are going to abstain not only from attacking civilians, but from any form of military actions. And that applies to all groups, even jihad group, which organized the last attack in Israel. I am sure, with some guarantees, that Israel would not continue the assassination policy, that we can have a complete, full military ceasefire for a very long time to come. That's one option. Second, Hamas is ready to accept two-state solution. They have declared that. They just say that they want us to recognize Israel. On which basis? Which Israel we have to recognize? According to which borders? Israel still is the only country in the world that does not define or declare what are its borders. So how can we recognize, they say so, how can we recognize Israel without knowing what are the borders of Israel? And if we recognize Israel, will that mean the initiation of a peace process and negotiations? There is no answer to this question. It's as if one side has to give up everything and the other side would give nothing.
Well, what if you said...
And I think there is a way out of this. The way out of this, this is what we proposed to several foreign ministers I had met recently in Europe, and many of them agree with my idea, that we should, the world community must call for an international peace conference like we did in Madrid. One condition of which would be that both sides recognize each other, And then have the peace conference negotiate the final status issues that should have already been finished by the year 1999, according to Oslo Agreement. And they were not finished because the Israeli people elected extreme groups like Likud. So we have to get back to negotiations, negotiate the final status issues, Jerusalem, borders, you know, settlements, and the issue of refugees, and get done with the conflict. I mean, time has come to just finish this problem. And what the Israeli government is saying is that we don't want to finish the problem. We want to impose our own reality on the ground. We'll annex half of the West Bank. We will keep Palestinians as prisoners in their clusters of communities surrounded by the wall and checkpoints. Excuse me, this is a recipe for disaster. This is bad for Israelis as much as it is bad for Palestinians. And what the world community must understand that without pressure on Israel, which has now the fourth largest military power in the world, and which is now the largest, fourth largest military exporter to the world, without pressure on them, this cannot change. You know, we have to find a way of changing that. Israel now enjoys a huge amount of support from the United States. On average, every Israeli family gets $12,000 of American taxpayers' money yearly and unlimited political support. There is no balance here, and the balance must be found so that the Palestinian issue would be resolved.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. I'm speaking with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, a member of the Palestinian Parliament and independent. He's neither a member of Fatah or Hamas. He's a longtime worker in the non-governmental organizational side. He was a founder of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society, which is doing a lot of great work in getting care to people in the occupied territories. What do you make of the embargo the United States and Europe are imposing on aid to the new government?
I think in the process of punishing Palestinians for their democratic choice, a process of collective punishment is taking place by hurting people economically, and that's wrong. This is not the way to go. I know people have the right, governments have the right to maybe have reservations about the new Palestinian government. We ourselves say that this government, that no party alone, Hamas or Fatah, can represent Palestinians anymore, and what we need is a coalition government, especially under the circumstances we live in. But I don't think that collective punishment of the Palestinian people, depriving people from medical equipment or medical or pharmaceuticals, or depriving people from food aid, or is something that will help improve the situation or make people less radical. On the contrary. On the other hand, I want to say something that is very important. We don't need aid because we are lazy people or because we cannot have a good economy. The aid that is directed to the occupied territories is actually an instrument to relieve the Israeli occupation from its responsibilities. And had we have a normal situation where there is no occupation and no checkpoints and normal trade and ability to export or import as people do in other countries, we would not need aid at all. We could become totally self-reliant and independent.
The notion from the Bush administration, Condoleezza Rice and Cheney probably, is that by essentially strangling Hamas financially, the government will fall.
And then?
I don't know what's going to happen then. I was going to ask you.
Suppose Hamas government falls. Who comes back to power? Fatah, with all its corrupt systems? Would Israel then negotiate with Fatah? I don't think so. I think what is missing here, I think here we have a cause and effect problem where you can really kill, as a medical doctor, I can tell you, you can kill the patient if you concentrate on the symptoms and forget about the cause of the disease. Hamas was elected because of the failure of the peace process. Hamas was elected because of the corrupt system that were created between Israeli authorities and the Palestinian authorities. Hamas was elected because the Western governments did not push Israel to continue the peace process and have a good result of the outcome of this peace process. Hamas got elected because of of the tolerance to Israeli practices in the occupied territories and the continuation of settlement activities, although this is illegal even according to American standards. So the result was Hamas election. It's not the cause. The cause is occupation. The cause is the inability of solving the problem. And that's why I want our democratic force, which we are building gradually and piece by piece, to become the alternative to both Hamas and Fatah. I want to be able to take over the government. And I think we can give better governance to Palestinians, internally and externally. And we work against Hamas and we compete with it. But if Hamas is to lose power, it has to lose it in a democratic way, not by collective economic punishment.
How unhelpful has the Bush administration been over the last few years? I know it gave its blessing, Colin Powell and Bush gave their blessing to Sharon's unilateralist policy.
The problem with the American policy, and this is really hurting the American interest in the region severely, is that it is buying to the Israeli narrative completely. Since Sharon came to power and he had this special relationship with Bush and his administration, and he worked hard on them before they came to power. And I'm sorry to say that the Israeli narrative is dominant still in Washington, and that is the reason why the United States not only is incapable of playing a positive and constructive role, but also it is practically hurting its own interest in the region, in the Islamic world, in the Arab world. There isn't an issue that would improve the American image or make it worse. There is no other issue more important than the Palestinian issue. And as long as Israel is allowed to oppress Palestinians and as long as the Palestinians are victims of this terrible occupation, I think the American, and as long as America supports Israel in this manner, I think the American interest will be hurt. And that's what I think the American administration is ought to think about. At the end of the day, it is supposed to defend the American interest and the interest of the American people. And in that sense, it has to revise, I think, its policy in the Middle East and decide what to do. I mean, there is this whole place is very boiling, and there is no stability at all. And the strategic stability in the region is mainly affected is affected to a large extent by the Palestinian factor.
So, what would you urge listeners to this program who are U.S. citizens to do about U.S. policy?
Well, first of all, I hope that American listeners would get to know the reality better, and I encourage them to look at our website. It's called Palestine Monitor. It's one word, palestinemonitor.org. It has lots of good information, and this is one way of getting to know the reality. I think the American public is entitled to knowing the truth, and then it is up to the Americans to decide their position independently. But what I see at the moment is that the American public is deprived from the possibility of getting an objective information, of complete objective knowledge of the factors on the ground, of the facts and the realities. And it is largely dominated by the American media is largely dominated by the Israeli narrative. So the first step for American people is to get to know the reality. It's not difficult. It's not complicated. It's simple. It's one Israeli government, which is very powerful, occupying the Palestinians and depriving them from the right of freedom and self-determination for so many years. And time has come for us to be free. So what I ask Americans to do is to do everything they can to inform themselves and then pressure their government to take a more reasonable and balanced position.
That's going to have to be the last word. Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, thanks so much for being my guest today. The website, again, is palestinemonitor.org.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.